shoulders. All sorts of sewing, actually. Susan shook her head. You all don't like me, she said. The women in this village never liked me. Lady Thornton pressed her lips together. She set her teacup down. That's not true, she said. Susan looked cross. Don't be patronizing, she said. Becky got along with your set because of the horses, but that's all. You never gave anyone a chance, Lady Thornton said. Most of the village came to the funeral. Oh, the funeral, bunch of nosy busybodies. I think you should make an effort, Lady Thornton said. You might be surprised, and it's good to be seen helping the war effort, don't you agree? This isn't the time to be isolationist. I had been listening closely. I asked, what's that mean? Lady Thornton said, an isolationist is someone who doesn't support the war, someone who wants us to stand apart, someone who doesn't care about things. I said, but she doesn't care about things. Susan looked like I'd slapped her. How can you say that? Of course I do. I shrugged. Is feeding you 3 meals a day not caring for you? She demanded. No, don't you look away. You look at me, Ada. When I confronted Jamie's teacher, wasn't that caring for him? Who knew she'd get so wound up? I tried to look away, but she put her hand under my chin and turned my face back toward her. Wasn't it? She insisted. I didn't want to answer, but I knew she wouldn't let go of me until I did. Maybe, I said at last. She released me and turned back to Lady Thornton, who was looking amused. I'll join, she said. As soon as Lady Thornton left, Susan told me off. What did you mean by complaining that I haven't got a proper job? What sort of job do you expect me to have? I shrugged. It surprised me how she could go on buying food without working, even though she did get paid for taking us. Mam works in the pub, I said. Well, I'm not doing that, she said. I did try to get a job when I first moved here with Becky. No one would have me, Oxford degree or not. Any position I was qualified for was reserved for men. Can't have a woman stealing a man's job now, can we? I didn't understand why we were having this conversation. Oh, she continued, me, in the WVS, all those wretched do-gooders. What nonsense. Why do soldiers need bed jackets? I asked. I wasn't sure what a bed jacket was. Who knows, Susan said. They're for hurt soldiers, I'd say, ones that have to go to hospital. I hadn't heard of any hurt soldiers. The ones that get blown up in the ocean, fall into the water and die, I said. I suppose so, Susan said, shuddering. But there are different kinds of battles. Some hurt soldiers survive. A few days later, Susan got her WVS uniform. She put it on to go to her first meeting. She looked nice in it. She wore stockings and leather shoes with heels. Quit staring, she said as she pulled on her gloves. You could come with me, a junior member, or perhaps a token evacuee. I shook my head. While she was gone, I thought I might try out the sewing machine, or cook something. The weather was wretched. I didn't want to ride. Why are you scared? I asked her. She made a face. All those proper housewives. I don't fit in. I never have. You've got the uniform, I said. She made another face. True. But it's not the outside that counts. Not with that group. Oh, well. She went away to her meeting. I stayed home and broke her sewing machine. Chapter 25 I didn't mean to. I'd watched Susan using it, and it looked easy, and all I was trying to do was sew two scraps of fabric together, for a start. But the scraps sucked into the bottom part of the machine, and the needle ran up and down through it anyway. A bunch of thread came out of nowhere, snarling itself into a knot. And then the machine made an awful noise, and then the needle snapped in two. I took my foot off the pedal. I stared at the tangle of thread and cloth, at the broken stump of the needle. I was going to get in awful trouble. Susan had been sewing every day since she finished our dressing gowns. She'd made herself a dress and made new shorts for Jamie. She loved the sewing machine. I couldn't think what to do. My stomach roiled. I fled upstairs and hid in the spare room, the room still full of Becky's things. I slid under the bed, deep into the corner. My mind went numb. I started to shake. Much later, I heard Susan come in the front door, heard her calling my name, heard Jamie climbing the stairs. He opened the door to our bedroom and shouted, "She's not up here!" "She has to be," that was Susan's voice. "Her crutches are right by the stairs." They called my name over and over. Jamie ran outside, ran back in. It grew darker. Finally, Susan's face poked under the edge of the bed. "You idiot girl! Why are you hiding?" I cringed against the far wall. Susan grabbed my arm and dragged me out. "What's wrong? Who frightened you?" I threw my hands over my head. "I'm not going to hit you," Susan shouted. "Stop that." Jamie came into the room.
"Was it the Germans?" he asked.
"Of course it wasn't the Germans," Susan said.
"Ada! Ada!"
She had an iron grip on my wrists, pulling my arms down. "What happened?"
"You'll send me back," I said. "You'll send me back."
All that time under the bed, my panic had grown worse and worse. I'd lose butter. Freedom. Jamie. "I won't send you back," Susan said. "But you'll tell me this instant what's wrong." She put a finger under my chin. "Look at me. Now, tell me." I looked at her, but only for a second. I squirmed away from her grasp. Finally, I gasped,
"I broke your sewing machine."
Susan sighed. "Look at me," she said. She tipped my chin up again. "You tried to use my sewing machine?" I nodded, squirmed away, looked at the ground. She tipped my chin up. "And you broke it?" I nodded. Looking her in the eye was nearly impossible. "It's okay," she said. "No matter what, it's okay." I couldn't believe her. It wasn't going to be okay. "You did do something wrong," she said. "You should have asked me first. But you don't need to be so afraid. I'm not going to hurt you because you made a mistake. Let's go see how badly it's broken." She made me go down the stairs to the living room. The fire was lit and the room was growing warm. It turned out that I'd only broken the needle, not the entire machine. Needles wore out sometimes, Susan said, and you had to replace them anyhow. She had an extra needle, so she took the broken one out and replaced it. Then she removed the snarled mess of cloth and thread. "It really is all right," she said. "Do you want to see what you did wrong?" I shook my head. My stomach hurt so bad. Susan pulled me over anyhow and showed me how the machine worked and how I'd needed to lever the needle into place before I started the machine running. "Tomorrow you can practice," Susan said. "No, thank you," I said. She pulled me close to her in a sort of one-armed embrace. "Why did you hide? Why were you under the bed?" Jamie had been hovering the entire time.
"Mam puts her in the cabinet," he said, "whenever she's really bad."
"But why put yourself there, Ada?" You didn't have to.
So I can stay. So I can stay, so I can stay, so I can stay.
I'm not going to shut you up anywhere, no matter what, okay?
Okay.
My stomach felt awful. My voice sounded very small. I could barely make my mind stay in the room with Susan and Jamie. I said,
I know I have to leave. Please, can Jamie come too?
Ada!
Oh no. Oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no. Without Jamie, I would die.
I'm not going to send you away. Why would I send you away? You made a mistake, a little, small mistake. Now both Susan's arms were around me. I tried to squirm free. She held me tighter.
Did you really think I'd send you away?
I nodded. Let me tell you something. When I was coming back from my meeting, I was thinking, maybe Ada will have made some tea. I was imagining how you'd have the lights on inside, and the blackout up, and I was thinking how lovely it was to have someone to come home to again. I used to dread going back to an empty house.
I'm sorry I didn't make tea, I said.
That's not what I'm trying to tell you, she said. I'm trying to say that I'm glad you're here. I couldn't come down from my panic. It took me most of the night before I could really breathe. Susan made tea, and when I couldn't swallow any, she didn't insist. I half wonder if I ought to give you a slug of brandy, she said. You'll never sleep in the state you're in. She made me take a hot bath, and she tucked the blankets tight around me. She was right. I lay awake half the night. But eventually I slept, and when I woke up, Jamie and I were still there. I could see butter out the back window. Susan was frying sausages for breakfast. And I could breathe again. Not long after that, Jamie came home from school, carrying the ugliest cat Susan and I had ever seen. Its filthy matted hair might have been any colour at all beneath the dirt. One eye was swollen shut. It glared at Susan and me out of its other.
I'm keeping him, Jamie announced, dumping the cat into the middle of the kitchen.
It swished its tail and hissed at us.
His name's Bovril. He's hungry.
Bovril was a hot drink Susan made for us most nights. It was nasty, but I'd gotten used to it. It had nothing whatsoever to do with cats. You're not keeping it, Susan said. Pick it up at once and put it out. It's crawling with fleas.
I am keeping it, Jamie said.
He picked the cat up. The cat went limp in his arms.
It's my onager. My own onager. His name's Bovril.
He began to go up the stairs. An onager was an animal from the Swiss Family Robinson book. Susan said onagers were like donkeys. You could ride them.
They were nothing like cats.
Don't you dare take that animal into your bedroom, Susan yelled after him.
I'm not, Jamie said. I'm giving him a bath.
Good Lord, Susan said to me. We'll have to call an ambulance. It'll scratch him to death. It didn't. Jamie bathed the mangy cat and drowned its fleas. He brought it back downstairs, wrapped in one of Susan's best towels. He fed it part of his meat from dinner. It'll hunt for itself after this, Susan said. I'm not cooking for a cat.
He's a good hunter, Jamie said, rubbing the cat's head. Aren't you, Bovril?
Every night after that, Jamie fell asleep with Bovril, curled in his arms. He never wet the bed again. By the end of the second week, Susan was offering Bovril saucers of watered milk. It's worth it, she told me. Saves me washing all those sheets. Chapter 26.
Susan tricked me into writing. Jamie was practicing his letters at the table in the evening after the dishes were washed. I sat down at my place and watched him.
Show Ada why you're left-handed, Susan suggested.
Jamie grinned. He moved his pencil from his left hand to his right. Immediately, the pencil started to skitter across the page. His letters went from small and neat to large and shaky.
You're fooling, I said, laughing at his grin.
I'm not, he said. I can't do it in this hand.
You try, Susan suggested. Try your left hand first. She took a fresh piece of paper and wrote a few letters on it. Copy that. I tried, but it was impossible. Even when I used my right hand to hold the page steady, my left hand couldn't control the pencil at all.
You're definitely right-handed, Susan said.
Move the pencil over, and you'll see. With my right hand, it was easy. I copied Susan's letters, and they looked almost as good as her own.
Well done, Susan said. You've just written your name.
That's my name.
Jamie looked over my shoulder.
Ada,
he said, nodding. Susan took the pencil back. And this is Jamie, she said. And here's Susan. Then she gave Jamie the pencil.
Keep on with your work, she said. Ada, would you put on some more coal?
I put the coal on, but first, when Susan wasn't looking, I slid the paper into my pocket. I'd borrow a pencil the next time she was out. I'd try it again. One afternoon, near the end of November, when I rode over to help Fred, he met me in the yard with a wide grin.
"Come look what I found," he said.
I dismounted, tied Butter's head, unslung my crutches, and followed him to the door of the tack room. He showed me a strange-looking saddle on a stand. It had a normal seat and one normal stirrup, but it also had two odd crooked knobs sticking up from the pommel.
"It's a side saddle," Fred said. "Must be 20, 30 years old, maybe more."
"So?"
"Here, I'll show you."
Fred scooped the saddle up. He exchanged it for Butter's, then tossed me into it. My left leg went into the stirrup, snug beneath one of the crooks. My right leg hung down on the stirrupless side.
"Now, you swing your right leg over, right here," he said.
He showed me how to tuck my right thigh around the other crook, so that my right leg actually draped over the pony's left shoulder.
"That's it," Fred said. "Now, shove your right hip back and get square in the saddle."
It felt very odd, but also snug and secure. As Butter had become more forward, my bad foot had become more of a problem. That I couldn't use the right stirrup was no issue, except that it tended to make me lean. But I couldn't use my right foot properly. I could thump him with it, but I couldn't keep any sort of proper contact with his side. My ankle, such as it was, didn't move that way.
"Now," Fred said, handing me a heavy leather-wrapped stick. "Here's your right leg."
"My leg?"
"Absolutely. You haven't got one of your own legs on the right side, see? So you hold one end of that stick and keep the other end on the pony. You'll signal him with it, just like you would with a regular leg."
Fred led us out to the field where I usually rode.
"Take a bit of time to get used to it, both for him and for you."
He was still grinning ear to ear.
"How's it feel so far?"
"Pretty good," I said.
My seat could still move with Butter's walk, but my legs felt firm.
"I didn't know they made saddles for cripples."
I wondered where Fred had found it, whose saddle it had been.
"No, not for cripples," Fred said. "This is how all proper ladies used to ride. Back when, straddling a horse wasn't thought to be ladylike. But after the war, things changed. The gentry women started riding astride. And after that, pretty much so did everyone."
"Which war?"
"Because the one we were in wasn't over."
"Last one.
20 years back.
Fred's face clouded. England lost 3 million men.
So they had lots of extra women, I said, and lots of men's saddles for them to use.
Suppose so.
He made me go around the field, first at the walk, then at the trot. Trotting was gobs easier in the side saddle. I still bounced, but I couldn't really get shaken loose.
That's enough for now, Fred said. You can practice running on your own. No jumping yet.
Never any jumping yet. When I'd finished my work, I went home by way of the tall hill above the village. Susan had drawn it on my map for me. At the top of the hill, I stopped and watched the ocean for a long time. Some days I saw ships far off in the distance, and once or twice a fishing boat closer in. Today there was nothing but glimmering sunlight, birds circling, tiny white waves crashing against the shore. Susan said there was sand at the water's edge, and when there wasn't a war, it was a lovely place to walk and look at the ocean. Just now, the beach was fenced with barbed wire, and planted with mines, which were bombs in the ground, in case of invasion. We'd walk on the beach when the war was over, Susan said. Susan didn't think I should accept the side saddle. She thought it was too valuable of a gift. She marched it and me over to Lady Thornton in the WVS office.
That old thing, Lady Thornton said. It must have been my aunt's. Mother never rode. Of course Ada may have it, or Grimes wouldn't have given it to her. Margaret doesn't want it, and neither do I.
Maggie sent me a letter from her school. Susan laid the envelope on the table one afternoon, and I traced the word I recognized on the front with my finger. Ada. I still had the paper where Susan had written my name, and I'd copied it over and over.
"Shall I read it to you?" Susan asked.
"No," I said. I opened the letter and stared at the marks on the paper inside. No matter how hard I stared, they didn't make sense. That night, I tried to get Jamie to read it.
"Her handwriting's all curly," he said. "I can't read that."
Still, I didn't want Susan to help me. In the end, I brought it to Fred. He chewed his pipe and said Maggie wanted us to ride together when she came home for Christmas holidays. "I won't be here for Christmas," I said. "The war will be over by then." Fred shook his head.
"I wouldn't think so," he said. "That's barely a month away. Doesn't seem to me that the war's properly started yet."
"Mam'll send for us," I said. "All the other evacuees are leaving."
Fred scratched behind his ear.
"Well, we'll hope not, won't we? Don't know what I'd do without you, I don't."
He grinned at me, and to my surprise, I grinned in return. I knew I couldn't really stay. The good things here, not being shut up in the one room, for starters, and then butter, and my crutches, and being warm even when it was cold outside. Clean clothes, nightly baths, 3 meals a day, that cup of Bovril before bedtime, the ocean seen from the top of the hill, all of these things. They were just temporary, just until Mam came for us. I didn't dare get too used to them. I tried to think of good things about home. I remembered Mam bringing home fish and chips on Friday nights, crisp and hot and wrapped in newspaper. I remembered that sometimes Mam sang, and laughed, and once even danced Jamie around the table. I remembered how when Jamie was little, he spent his days inside with me. I remembered the crack on the ceiling that looked like a man in a pointed hat. And even if it felt like Mam hated me, she had to love me, didn't she? She had to love me, because she was my Mam, and Susan was just somebody who got stuck taking care of Jamie and me
because of the war. She still said so sometimes. I didn't ask for evacuees, she said, when Bovril puked mouse guts on the living room rug. I don't need this, she said, shaking her head when Jamie came home with his sweater ripped, smeared in dirt from head to toe. I never wanted children, she said, when Butter shied at a pheasant and dumped me in the road and ran home with my crutches tied to the saddle. Susan came out to find me, muttering, crutches in hand, and when she saw me she scowled and said it was a mercy I wasn't killed. I never wanted children.
I never wanted you, I said.
I can't imagine why not, she said, snorting. I'm so loving and kind. The wind had come up sharp, and it was nearly full dark. I was shivering. When we got home, Susan draped a blanket around my shoulders. Make us some tea, she said. I'll put up the wretched pony. She squared her shoulders and stalked into the night, and I watched her go and wanted Mam. I wanted Mam to be like Susan. I didn't really trust Susan not to be like Mam. Chapter 27 Susan took us back to see Dr. Graham.
I can't believe it's the same children, he said.
Jamie was 2 inches taller, and I was 3. We were heavier, too, and I'd grown strong from riding and helping Fred. With my crutches, I could walk for ages without getting tired. We didn't have impetigo, or lice, or scabs on our legs, or anything. We were the picture of health, he said. Then he took my bad foot and wriggled it.
"Still nothing?"
he asked Susan. She shook her head. "I've invited her to visit for Christmas," she said. "If she comes, I hope to convince her."
"Who?" asked Jamie.
"Never you mind," Susan replied. I was hardly paying attention. My mind always wandered into its own corner when strangers touched me. Susan tapped my shoulder. "Does this hurt?" she asked. I shook my head. My foot hurt. It always did. But Dr. Graham wiggling it didn't make it hurt worse. I just didn't like it.
If perhaps you could do this every day, he said, twisting my foot as though unringing a cloth,
as though he could make it look more normal.
If she could gain some flexibility, that would only be a help for later on.
Special shoes, I said, my mind coming back to me. Fred said clubfoot horses had special shoes. Dr. Graham let go of my foot.
That won't be enough at this stage, he said. I'm convinced you'll require surgical intervention.
Oh, I said, not having any idea what he meant.
Still, he said, massage might help, and certainly can do no harm.
It turned out he meant Miss Smith was going to rub and tug at my foot every night. We'd already switched to reading Swiss Family Robinson in the blacked-out living room after dinner, snug by the coal fire that didn't quite heat our bedrooms upstairs. Now Susan sat on one edge of the sofa, nearest a lamp, while I sat on the other and stretched my feet onto her lap. Jamie and his cat lay by the fire on the rug.
"Your foot is so cold," Susan said the first evening. "Doesn't it feel cold?"
I nodded. We were still keeping it bandaged, but the bandage tended to get damp, and my foot was nearly always freezing.
"I don't mind," I said. "When it gets numb, I can't feel it."
Susan looked at me, puzzled. I said, "When it gets numb, it doesn't hurt." She winced.
"You could get frostbite," she said.
"That wouldn't be good for you. We need a better plan." In typical Susan fashion, she set about making one. First, she took one of her own thick wool stockings, which were bigger than mine and easier to slide over my inflexible ankle. Then she messed around with an old pair of slippers and a needle and thread. And pretty soon I had a sort of house shoe with a leather bottom and knit top. It didn't keep my foot completely dry, but it helped a lot.
"Hmm," Susan said, studying the shoe. "We'll keep working."
She had her sewing machine going all the time now, 3 or 4 hours a day. She made bed jackets for soldiers from cloth the WVS gave her. She made a coat for Jamie out of an old woolen coat she said had been Becky's. She went through a pile of old clothes and ripped them apart at the seams, then washed and pressed the cloth pieces, and cut and sewed them into different things entirely. "The government calls it make do and mend," Susan said. "I call it how I was raised. My mother was an excellent manager."
"Does your mother hate you?" I asked.
Her face clouded.
"No. She's dead, remember?"
"Did she hate you when she was alive?"
"I hope not," Susan said.
"But you said your father doesn't like you."
"No. He thinks my going to university was a bad idea."
"Did your mother think that?"
"I don't know," Susan said. "She always did whatever my father wanted." She stopped pinning pieces of cloth together.
"It wasn't a good thing," she said.
"It made her unhappy, but she did it anyway."
"But you didn't do what your father wanted," I said.
"It's complicated," Susan said. "At first, he was pleased when I won a place at Oxford. Only later he said he didn't like the way it changed me. He thought all women should get married, and I didn't do that, and... it's complicated. Only I'm not sorry I made the choices I did. If I had it to do over, I'd make them again."
Susan made Jamie a pair of nice shorts to wear to church, out of an old tweed skirt that had once been Becky's. She recut the jacket that had gone with the skirt, and turned it into a short, heavy coat I could wear when I was riding. Since the day I broke Susan's sewing machine, I'd refused to touch it. But Susan started to teach me how to sew by hand. She said it was better to learn that way first, anyhow. She showed me how to sew on buttons, and I sewed the buttons onto all the bed jackets she made, and my jacket, and the flap on Jamie's shorts. At the WVS meeting, she told the other women that I had helped her. She said so when she came home. One day, she rummaged around in her bedroom and came out with an armful of wool yarn. She got out wooden sticks. She looped the yarn around the sticks and pretty soon had made warm hats for Jamie and me, and mufflers, and mittens to keep our hands warm. My mittens looked like they had 2 thumbs apiece. Susan showed me how one thumb part went over my thumb, and the other went over my littlest finger. She had taken very thin scraps of leather and sewed them across the palms. "They're riding mittens," she said, watching my face. "See?"
I saw.
When I'd first started riding Butter, I'd held the reins in my fists, but Fred insisted I do it the proper way, threading them through my 3rd and 4th fingers and out over my thumb. In these mittens, I could hold the reins right, and the leather strips would keep the yarn from wearing away.
"I made them up," Susan said.
"They were all my own idea. Do you like them?" It was one of those times when I knew the answer she wanted from me, but didn't want to give it.
"They're okay," I said,
and then, relenting a little, "thank you."
"Sourpuss," she said, laughing. "Would it kill you to be grateful?"
Maybe. Who knew?
The vicar came over on a Saturday with a gang of boys and built an Anderson shelter in the back garden for us. Anderson shelters were little tin huts that were supposed to be safe from bombs. Ours didn't look safe. It looked small
and dark and flimsy. The bottom half of it was buried in the ground, and you had to go down 3 steps to open the little door. Inside, there was just room for 2 long benches, facing each other. Susan said we wouldn't have been able to dig the hole ourselves, not if we worked all week on it. She took drinks out to the vicar and said so. The vicar, sweating in his shirt sleeves, said it was his pleasure. They'd been putting up Anderson shelters all over the village. It was good work for the boys. Some of the boys were evacuees, and some weren't. One was Stephen White. He grinned and rested his shovel when I went over to him. "So, you're not busy every day?" he asked.
"I am busy," I said. "I ride, I help Fred Grimes, I do things."
"I just meant you said you were too busy to come to tea." He used a dirty hand to push his hair away from his face, and it left a smear of mud on his cheek. Still, like me, he looked better than he had in London. His clothes were neat and clean, and he was taller. Something about his grin made me feel I could trust him. "I wouldn't know what to do at tea," I said. He shrugged. "Sure you do. Bet you have tea every night."
"But that colonel..."
"He's an old duck, he is. You'd like him once you got to know him."
"How come you didn't go home with the rest of your family?"
I'd been wanting to ask for ages. Stephen looked uncomfortable. "The colonel's mostly blind," he said. "You've seen him. And he's got no family. And when I first got here, he was really feeble. A bunch of the food he'd been eating had gone bad. Only he's lost his sense of taste, too, so he couldn't tell. And so it made him sick. And his house was just awful. Bugs everywhere, and rats, and he couldn't fix any of it. I cleaned the place up. The vicar's wife taught me to cook. Just easy things, and she brings us food sometimes, too. She's nice. And I read to the colonel, and he likes that. He's got piles of books."
Stephen picked his shovel back up and started heaving dirt onto the top of the shelter.
"Mum's after me to come home. I'd like to go. I miss home, I do. But if I leave, the colonel'll die. He really will. He's got no one."
Stephen looked around the muddy garden, at the house and stable and Butter's field.
"Pretty nice place here."
"Yes."
"Your mam ain't come for you?"
"No, she doesn't want us."
He nodded. "Just as well. She shouldn't have shut you up like she did."
I shivered as the wind whipped higher. "It was because of my foot."
Stephen shook his head. "Foot's the same, isn't it?" he said. "And you're not shut up now. Come to tea sometime. The colonel likes having visitors."
When everyone had gone, I stood just outside the door of the shelter. I didn't like it. It was dark and damp and cold. It smelled like Mam's cupboard beneath the sink. Goosebumps rose on my arms and my stomach churned. I didn't go inside. Susan stocked the shelter with blankets, bottles of water, candles, and matches. She said air raid sirens would go off if enemy planes were coming to bomb us. We would hear the sirens and run into the shelter and be safe.
"What about Bovril?" Jamie asked anxiously.
Bovril could come into the shelter. Susan found an old basket with a lid on it and put it into the shelter. If Bovril was scared, Jamie could shut him in the basket.
"He won't be scared," Jamie said. "He's never scared."
Butter wouldn't fit in the shelter.
Chapter 28. It was cold now, and dark came early. The colour had leached out of the grass in Butter's field, and he'd started to grow thin. When I showed this to Susan, she sighed.
"It's all the exercise you're giving him," she said.
"He used to be fat enough he could winter over
on grass. She bought hay, and we stacked it in one of the empty stalls. She bought a bag of oats, too. Every day I took butter 3 or 4 flakes of hay and a bucket of grain. He still lived outside. Fred said it was healthier for him, as well as being less work for us. Back when the leaves had first started changing colour on the trees, I'd been alarmed. Susan promised that it happened every year. The leaves changed colour and fell off, and the trees would look dead all winter, but they wouldn't actually be dead. In spring, they'd grow new green leaves again. Susan had gotten over being surprised at all the things we didn't know. When she showed me how to cook or sew something, she always started at the very beginning. This is a needle. Look, it has a little hole on one end for the thread to loop through, and a point on the other end, so it can go into cloth. Or, eggs have a clear part, called the white, and a yellow part, called the yolk. You break an egg by tapping it on the edge of the table, and then cracking it open with your hands, only over the bowl, like this. Susan said winter usually made her feel sad and gloomy, the way she was when we first came. This winter, though, she was almost too busy to be sad. She had to shop and cook and clean and do the wash. She was particular about the wash. And sew and go to meetings. But as the days grew shorter, she did seem sad. She made an effort for us, but you could tell it was an effort. She was always tired. I tried to be helpful. I cooked and sewed buttons. I went with her to the shops. I learned to hem bed jackets. Meanwhile, I still helped Fred twice a week, and I rolled butter every day. On a rainy, cold Wednesday afternoon, Susan sat slumped in her chair. I had finished washing the lunch dishes. Jamie had gone to school. The fire was burning low, so I added coal and poked it up a little. "Thank you," Susan murmured. She looked frail and shivery. She'd spilled a bit of potato from lunch down the front of her blouse and not scrubbed it clean, which wasn't like her. I didn't want her staying in bed all day again. I sat down on the sofa and I looked at her and I said, "Maybe you could show me how to read." She looked up disinterestedly. "Now?" I shrugged. She sighed. "Oh, very well." We went to the kitchen table and she got out a pencil and paper. "All the words in the world are made up of just 26 letters," she said. "There's a big and a little version of each." She wrote the letters out on the paper and named them all. Then she went through them again. Then she told me to copy them onto another piece of paper. And then she went back to her chair. I stared at the paper. I said, "This isn't reading, this is drawing." "Writing," she corrected. "It's like buttons and hems. You've got to learn those before you can sew on the machine. You've got to know your letters before you can read." I supposed so, but it was boring. When I said so, she got up again and wrote something along the bottom of the paper. "What's that?" I asked. "Ada is a curmudgeon," she replied. "Ada is a curmudgeon," I copied at the end of my alphabet. It pleased me. After that, with help from Jamie, I left Susan little notes every day. "Susan is a big frog." That one made Jamie giggle. "Butter is the best pony ever." "Jamie sings like a squirrel." And then some papers I kept because they were useful, and I could put them on the kitchen table whenever I needed to leave Susan a message. It made her happier when she knew where we were. "Ada is at Fred's. Ada is riding Butter. Jamie went to the airfield." He wasn't supposed to, but he did. They'd gotten so used to him sneaking in under the fence that they hardly bothered to scold him any more.
Only, if they say I have to leave right away,
Jamie told us.
If they don't say so, I can stay and talk to them.
Planes fascinated him. He made friends with the pilots, and they let him sit inside the Spitfires when they were parked on the field. Susan asked us how we usually celebrated Christmas. We didn't know what to say. Christmas was a big day at the pub, so Mam always worked. She'd get lots of tips, and usually we'd have something good to eat. Fish and chips, or a meat pie.
"Do you hang up your stockings?" Susan asked.
Jamie frowned.
"What for?"
We'd heard of Father Christmas. It was something other children talked about, but we didn't get visits from him. I said,
"What do you usually do?"
Her face went soft, remembering.
The Christmases when Becky was alive, we'd have a big dinner with some of our friends, she said. Roast goose or turkey.
In the morning, we'd exchange presents. We always had a little tree, and we'd decorate the window sills with holly. And then we'd have something wonderful for breakfast, hot sticky buns and bacon and coffee. And then we'd just laze around until it was time to start making dinner. On Boxing Day, Becky would go hunting. When I was little, my family all went to midnight services on Christmas Eve. My father would preach. The church always looked beautiful in the cold candlelight. Then I'd go to sleep, such a short sleep, and wake up to my stocking filled with little presents at the foot of my bed. The bigger gifts were downstairs, under the tree. Mother cooked a huge meal, and all the aunts and uncles and cousins came. Her voice trailed away. "We'll do something nice," she said, "for your first Christmas here."
"Can Mam come?" Jamie asked.
Susan put her hand on his head. "I hope she will," she said. "I've invited her, but I haven't gotten a reply."
"I'll write to her," Jamie said.
"You don't have to," I told him. It seemed risky. If we reminded Mam that we were here, would she come and get us?
"We need to talk to her about your foot," Susan said.
"Well, I'm not writing," I said. I had memorized the alphabet and was starting to understand how the letters should sound, so that I could read even words I hadn't seen before. I could write, a bit, but not to Mam.
"You don't have to," Susan said, her arm around me. The shops filled with the most amazing things, oranges and nuts and all sorts of candy and toys. Susan said people were determined to have a happy Christmas despite the war. She herself ordered a goose, since Jamie and I had never had one, and then she invited some of the pilots from the airfield to come eat it with us, because the goose was too big for the three of us alone. I invited Fred, but he said he always went to his brother's house, and he didn't like to break tradition.
"But thank you kindly," he added.
So I invited Maggie. It seemed right to me that if Jamie got to have pilots, I should have a friend to dinner too. Besides Fred, and maybe Stephen, Maggie was the only friend I had. She came back from her school the week before Christmas. We rode together up the big hill, where the wind was blowing hard, and we could see down to the barricaded beach. Maggie was different, stiffer, and more standoffish than she'd been the day I rode her home. She looked elegant on her pony, with her leather gloves and her little velvet cap. I put my hand up to shield my eyes. Riding up the hill had been my idea. "I always check for spies when I'm up here," I said. "We're supposed to, you know." We were told so by the government men on the radio. Nazi spies could be dressed as nurses, or nuns, or anything.
"I know," Maggie said crossly. "I'm not stupid."
Then she added,
"Why didn't you write back to me? I asked you to."
I hadn't known she'd asked me. Fred hadn't read me that part of her letter. And while I'd had another couple of goes at reading it, Maggie's handwriting was curly, with the letters run together. I couldn't make out the words. I was ashamed to admit this.
"I've been very busy," I said.
She flashed me a look of hurt and anger. I understood suddenly that she'd been waiting for me to write back, waiting and hoping for a letter. I didn't know she felt that way about me. I took a deep breath. "I'm just now learning to write," I said, "and read, so I couldn't write back yet. I'm sorry. Next time I'll try." Instead of looking horrified by my ignorance, she looked mollified. Susan taught me that word, and I loved it. Mollified. Sometimes when Jamie was cross, he had to be mollified.
"I didn't think of that," she said. "I thought you just weren't interested. But wouldn't Miss Smith have helped you? She would have written down what you wanted to say."
She would have, if I'd asked.
"I didn't want to ask her. I don't like her helping me."
"Why ever not?" "I don't want to get used to her," I said. "She's just someone we have to stay with for a little while. She's not, you know, actually real." Maggie looked me up and down.
"She seems real to me," she said. "I saw you the day you got off that train. You looked like you'd already been through a war. Then you looked better the day you helped me. And now, side saddle on a pony, and fancy clothes, and not so skinny your bones show. Your eyes are different, too. Before, you looked scared to death."
I didn't want to talk about it.
There weren't any spies in view, nor any ships, and Butter was tired of standing in the wind. "Race you to the village," I said.
Chapter 29. Maggie won, but not by much, and I stayed in the saddle the whole time, even though Butter galloped faster than he'd ever gone before. We followed Maggie's pony over two fallen logs, little soaring jumps, my first. By the time we pulled up on the outskirts of town, both ponies blowing hard, Maggie's hair had come loose from its plait, and her cheeks were bright red. She was laughing. She'd forgotten I ever looked scared. I knew Susan wasn't real. Or, if she was a tiny bit real, sometimes, at the very best she was only temporary. She'd be done with us once the war was over, or whenever Mam changed her mind. Maggie couldn't come for Christmas dinner. She said she wished she could, but her brother was expected home from aviation training, and her father was coming from wherever he was doing secret war work, and they were all having their traditional Christmas. So of course she had to stay home.
"It'll be a miserable day," she said. "Mum will be trying not to blubber over Jonathan, so she'll be snippy with everyone. Dad's wound up about Hitler and won't talk about anything but the war, especially since there's no hunting. And Mum hates talking about the war. The cook quit to work in a factory, and the housekeeper's an awful cook. And we've not got but one maid left, and no footman in the house at all. So I'll be scrubbing on Christmas Eve, and Mum will be trying to help cook. And we'll sit down in this big fancy room with cobwebs in the corners and eat horrible food and pretend to be cheerful, and nothing will be like it used to." "People keep saying it isn't really a war," she said. "Hardly anybody's being bombed. Hardly anybody's fighting. It feels like a war to me. A war right in my family." She gave me a sideways look. "You're probably happy," she said.
"I'm not happy because you're miserable," I shot back.
She shook her head. "Oh, of course not. Come on."
We were riding again, but this time we took a path Maggie chose, through woods down to the beach. We had to stay on the far side of the barbed wire, but we followed the road along the beach and watched the waves crash against the shore. It amazed me how different the ocean could look from day to day.
Susan took an axe and made us go with her out into somebody's field and cut down a little tree. It was not a tree that went dead in the winter. It had little green spikes on its branches instead of leaves, and Susan called it an evergreen. It was snowing, and the air was wet and cold.
"What for?" I asked.
Susan and Jamie lugged the tree home while I walked with my crutches beside them.
"Christmas trees," Susan said, "remind us that God is like an evergreen tree, even in winter, never dead."
"But you said the other trees weren't dead either," Jamie pointed out.
"Well, no, they're not," Susan said. "But they look dead, and Christmas trees are a nice tradition. Green in the midst of winter, light in the midst of darkness. It's all metaphors for God."
I ignored the word metaphor, but asked, "What's Christmas got to do with God?"
"Well, you would think I'd said something really odd." Susan gaped at me, mouth open, fish-like, and when she finally closed her mouth, she sputtered.
"Haven't you been learning anything going to church?"
I shrugged.
"Church was hard to follow. Sometimes the stories made sense, but mostly they didn't. And although the vicar seemed nice, I almost never actually listened to him. I might have liked the songs if I could have read them fast enough to actually sing."
It turned out Christmas was Jesus's birthday. Jesus was the man hanging on the cross up in the front of the church. I already knew that part. So, easy enough. But then Jamie asked,
"How did they know when Jesus's birthday was?"
Susan said, "Well, I don't suppose they did know. Not absolutely."
Jamie nodded.
"Like Ada and me."
"Right," Susan said. "But we've got your pretend birthdays on your identity cards, so we'll celebrate your birthdays on those days. Christmas is like that."
Jamie said, "Was Christmas the birthday on Jesus's identity card?"
"You stupid," I said. "Jesus wasn't in a war."
"Don't call him stupid," Susan said.
"It was a stupid thing to say."
"Saying something stupid doesn't make you stupid," Susan said, "luckily for all of us." We took the tree into the house and set it up in the corner of the living room. Susan put a string of little electric lights in its branches. She went into Becky's room upstairs and came out with a big box. She looked inside, blinked back tears, and shut the box again.
"Let's make our own ornaments," she said. "Wouldn't you like that?"
"How would I know?" I could tell she wanted me to like it, and I didn't want her to cry. It made me nervous when she cried.
"Yes?" I said.
"Oh, Ada." She gave me a hug with her free arm. I took a deep breath and didn't pull away. "These are the ornaments Becky and I put on our trees together. I'm not ready to have them out again."
"Okay," I said.
"Okay?" she asked. "Really?"
I didn't know what to say. Somehow Christmas was making me feel jumpy inside. All this talk about being together and being happy and celebrating, it felt threatening. Like I shouldn't be part of it. Like I wasn't allowed. And Susan wanted me to be happy, which was scarier still.
Ornaments were little pretty things you hung on a Christmas tree. Susan got out coloured paper and scissors and glue. She showed us how to make snowflakes and stars. I worked hard to make mine as good as hers. Jamie cut his paper quick into ragged shapes. We hung them all up, ragged and careful both. And the tree did look pretty in the corner of the room. Bovril thought so too. He lay under it during the day, patting the lowest ornaments with his paws. Jamie wadded up some of the leftover paper, and in the evenings tossed it back and forth across the floor for Bovril to pounce upon.
I hated sharing my bed with a cat. Sometimes I woke with a tail in my face, and they're always